Chapter 8. Why There Is No I in AI. Since its inception in 1956, the field of artificial intelligence has gone through several cycles of enthusiasm, followed by pessimism. AI scientists call these AI summers and AI winters. Each wave was based on a new technology that promised to put us on the path to creating intelligent machines. But ultimately, these innovations fell short. AI is currently experiencing another wave of enthusiasm, another AI summer. And once again, expectations in the industry are high. The set of technologies driving the current surge are artificial neural networks, often referred to as deep learning. These methods have achieved impressive results on tasks such as labeling pictures, recognizing spoken language, and driving cars. In 2011, a computer beat the top-ranked humans playing the game show Jeopardy. And in 2016, another computer bested the world's top-ranked player of the game, Go. These last two accomplishments made headlines around the world. These achievements are impressive. But are any of these machines truly intelligent? Most people, including most AI researchers, don't think so. There are numerous ways today's artificial intelligence falls short of human intelligence. For example, humans learn continuously. As I described earlier, we are constantly amending our model of the world. In contrast, deep learning networks have to be fully trained before they can be deployed. And once they are deployed, they can't learn new things on the go. For example, if we want to teach a vision neural network to recognize an additional object, then the network has to be retrained from the ground up, which can take days. However, the biggest reason that today's AI systems are not considered intelligent is they can only do one thing, whereas humans can do many things. In other words, AI systems are not flexible. Any individual human, such as you or me, can learn to play Go, to farm, to write software, to fly a plane, and to play music. We learn thousands of skills in our lifetime, and although we may not be the best at any one of these skills, we are flexible in what we can learn. Deep learning AI systems exhibit almost no flexibility. A Go-playing computer may play the game better than any human, but it can't do anything else. A self-driving car may be a safer driver than any human, but it can't play Go or fix a flat tire. The long-term goal of AI research is to create machines that exhibit human-like intelligence, machines that can rapidly learn new tasks, see analogies between different tasks, and flexibly solve new problems. This goal is called artificial general intelligence, or AGI, to distinguish it from today's limited AI. The essential question today's AI industry faces is, are we currently on a path to creating truly intelligent AGI machines, or will we once again get stuck and enter another AI winter? The current wave of AI has attracted thousands of researchers and billions of dollars of investment. Almost all these people and dollars are being applied to improving deep learning technologies. Will this investment lead to human-level machine intelligence, or are deep learning technologies fundamentally limited, leading us once again to reinvent the field of AI? When you are in the middle of a bubble, it is easy to get swept up in the enthusiasm and believe it will go on forever. History suggests we should be cautious. I don't know how long the current wave of AI will continue to grow, but I do know that deep learning does not put us on the path to creating truly intelligent machines. We can't get to artificial general intelligence by doing more of what we are currently doing. We have to take a different approach. Two paths to AGI. There are two paths that AI researchers have followed to make intelligent machines. One path, the one we are following today, is focused on getting computers to outperform humans on specific tasks, such as playing Go or detecting cancerous cells in medical images. The hope is that if we can get computers to outperform humans on a few difficult tasks, then eventually we will discover how to make computers better than humans at every task. With this approach to AI, it doesn't matter how the system works, and it doesn't matter if the computer is flexible. It only matters that the AI computer performs a specific task better than other AI computers, and ultimately better than the best human. For example, if the best Go-playing computer was ranked 6th in the world, it would not have made headlines, and it might even be viewed as a failure. But beating the world's top-ranked human was seen as a major advance. The second path to creating intelligent machines is to focus on flexibility. With this approach, it isn't necessary that the AI performs better than humans. The goal is to create machines that can do many things and apply what they learn from one task to another. Success along this path could be a machine that has the abilities of a 5-year-old child, or even a dog. The hope is that if we can first understand how to build flexible AI systems, then with that foundation, we can eventually make systems that equal or surpass humans. This second path was favored in some of the earlier waves of AI. However, it proved to be too difficult. Scientists realized that to be as capable as a 5-year-old child requires possessing a huge amount of everyday knowledge. Children know thousands of things about the world. They know how liquids spill, balls roll, and dogs bark. They know how to use pencils, markers, paper, and glue. They know how to open books and that paper can rip. They know thousands of words and how to use them to get other people to do things. AI researchers couldn't figure out how to program this everyday knowledge into a computer or how to get a computer to learn these things. The difficult part of knowledge is not stating a fact, but representing that fact in a useful way. For example, take the statement balls around. A 5-year-old child knows what this means. We can easily enter this statement into a computer, but how can a computer understand it? The words ball and round have multiple meanings. A ball can be a dance which isn't round, and a pizza is round, but not like a ball. For a computer to understand ball, it has to associate the word with different meanings, and each meaning has different relationships to other words. Objects also have actions. For example, some balls bounce, but footballs bounce differently than baseballs, which bounce differently than tennis balls. You and I quickly learn these differences by observation. No one has to tell us how balls bounce. We just throw a ball to the ground and see what happens. We aren't aware of how this knowledge is stored in our brain. Learning everyday knowledge, such as how balls bounce, is effortless. AI scientists couldn't figure out how to do this with a computer. They invented software structures called schemas and frames to organize knowledge, but no matter what they tried, they ended up with an unusable mess. The world is complex. The number of things a child knows and the number of links between those things seems impossibly large. I know it sounds like it should be easy, but no one could figure out how a computer could know something as simple as what a ball is. This problem is called knowledge representation. Some AI scientists concluded that knowledge representation was not only a big problem for AI, it was the only problem. They claimed that we could not make truly intelligent machines until we solved how to represent everyday knowledge in a computer. Today's deep learning networks don't possess knowledge. A Go-playing computer does not know that Go is a game. It doesn't know the history of the game. It doesn't know if it is playing against a computer or a human, or what computer and human mean. Similarly, a deep learning network that labels images may look at an image and say it is a cat. But the computer has limited knowledge of cats. It doesn't know that cats are animals or that they have tails, legs, and lungs. It doesn't know about cat people versus dog people or that cats purr and shed fur. All the deep learning network does is determine that a new image is similar to previously seen images that were labeled cat. There is no knowledge of cats in the deep learning network. Recently, AI scientists have tried a different approach to encoding knowledge. They create large artificial neural networks and train them on lots of text, every word in tens of thousands of books, all of Wikipedia, and almost the entire internet. They feed the text into the neural networks one word at a time. By training this way, the networks learn the likelihood that certain words follow other words. These language networks can do some surprising things. For example, if you give the network a few words, it can write a short paragraph related to those words. It is difficult to tell whether the paragraph was written by a human or by the neural network. AI scientists disagree as to whether these language networks possess true knowledge or are just mimicking humans by remembering the statistics of millions of words. I don't believe any kind of deep learning network will achieve the goal of AGI if the network doesn't model the world the way a brain does. Deep learning networks work well, but not because they solved the knowledge representation problem. They work well because they avoided it completely, relying on statistics and lots of data instead. How deep learning networks work is clever. Their performance is impressive, and they are commercially valuable. I am only pointing out that they don't possess knowledge, and therefore are not on the path to having the ability of a 5-year-old child. Brains as a model for AI. From the moment I became interested in studying the brain, I felt that we would have to understand how it works before we could create intelligent machines. This seemed obvious to me, as the brain is the only thing that we know of that is intelligent. Over the following decades, nothing changed my opinion. That is one reason I have doggedly pursued brain theory. I feel it is a necessary first step to creating truly intelligent AI. I've lived through multiple waves of AI enthusiasm, and each time I resisted jumping on board. It was clear to me that the technologies used were not even remotely like the brain, and therefore, AI would get stuck. Figuring out how the brain works is hard, but it is a necessary first step to creating intelligent machines. In the first half of this book, I described the progress we have made in understanding the brain. I described how the neocortex learns models of the world using map-like reference frames. In the same way that a paper map represents knowledge about a geographic area, such as a town or a country, the maps in the brain represent knowledge about the objects we interact with, such as bicycles and smartphones. Knowledge about our body, such as where our limbs are and how they move, and knowledge about abstract concepts, such as mathematics. The thousand brains theory solves the problem of knowledge representation. Here is an analogy to help you understand how. Let's say I want to represent knowledge about a common object, a stapler. Early AI researchers would try to do this by listing the names of the different parts of the stapler and then describing what each part does. They might write a rule about staplers that says, when the top of the stapler is pressed down, a staple comes out of one end. But to understand this statement, words such as top, end, and staple had to be defined, as did the meaning of the different actions such as pressed down and comes out. And this rule is insufficient on its own. It doesn't say which way the staple faces when it comes out, what happens next, or what you should do if the staple gets stuck. So the researchers would write additional rules. This method of representing knowledge led to a never-ending list of definitions and rules. AI researchers didn't see how to make it work. Critics argued that even if all the rules could be specified, the computer still wouldn't know what a stapler is. The brain takes a completely different approach to storing knowledge about a stapler. It learns a model. The model is the embodiment of knowledge. Imagine for a moment that there is a tiny stapler in your head. It is exactly like a real stapler. It has the same shape, the same parts, and it moves in the same ways. It's just smaller. The tiny model represents everything you know about staplers without needing to put a label on any of the parts. If you want to recall what happens when the top of a stapler is pressed down, you press down on the miniature model and see what happens. Of course, there isn't a tiny physical stapler in your head, but the cells in the neocortex learn a virtual model that serves the same purpose. As you interact with a real stapler, the brain learns its virtual model, which includes everything you have observed about the real stapler, from its shape to how it behaves when you use it. Your knowledge of staplers is embedded in the model. There isn't a list of stapler facts and stapler rules stored in your brain. Let's say I ask you what happens when the top of a stapler is pushed down. To answer this question, you don't find the appropriate rule and play it back to me. Instead, your brain imagines pressing down on the stapler, and the model recalls what happens. You can use words to describe it to me, but the knowledge is not stored in words or rules. The knowledge is the model. I believe the future of AI will be based on brain principles. Truly intelligent machines, AGI, will learn models of the world using map-like reference frames just like the neocortex. I see this as inevitable. I don't believe there is another way to create truly intelligent machines. Moving from dedicated to universal AI solutions. The situation we are in today reminds me of the early days of computing. The word computer originally referred to people whose job was to perform mathematical calculations. To create numeric tables or to decode encrypted messages, dozens of human computers would do the necessary calculations by hand. The very first electronic computers were designed to replace human computers for a specific task. For example, the best automated solution for message decryption was a machine that only decrypted messages. Computing pioneers such as Alan Turing argued that we should build universal computers, electronic machines that could be programmed to do any task. However, at that time, no one knew the best way to build such a computer. There was a transitionary period where computers were built in many different forms. There were computers designed for specific tasks. There were analog computers and computers that could only be repurposed by changing the wiring. There were computers that worked with decimal instead of binary numbers. Today, almost all computers are the universal form that Turing envisioned. We even refer to them as universal Turing machines. With the right software, today's computers can be applied to almost any task. Market forces decided that universal, general-purpose computers were the way to go. This is despite the fact that even today, any particular task can be performed faster or with less power using a custom solution, such as a special chip. Product designers and engineers usually prefer the lower cost and convenience of general-purpose computers, even though a dedicated machine could be faster and use less power. A similar transition will occur with artificial intelligence. Today, we are building dedicated AI systems that are the best at whatever task they are designed to do. But in the future, most intelligent machines will be universal, more like humans, capable of learning practically anything. Today's computers come in many shapes and sizes, from the microcomputer in a toaster to room-size computers used for weather simulation. Despite their differences in size and speed, all these computers work on the same principles laid out by Turing and others many years ago. They are all instances of universal Turing machines. Similarly, intelligent machines of the future will come in many shapes and sizes, but almost all of them will work on a common set of principles. Most AI will be universal learning machines, similar to the brain. Mathematicians have proven that there are some problems that cannot be solved, even in principle. Therefore, to be precise, there are no true universal solutions. But this is a highly theoretical idea, and we don't need to consider it for the purposes of this book. Some AI researchers argue that today's artificial neural networks are already universal. A neural network can be trained to play Go or drive a car. However, the same neural network can't do both. Neural networks also have to be tweaked and modified in other ways to get them to perform a task. When I use the terms universal or general purpose, I imagine something like ourselves, a machine that can learn to do many things without erasing its memory and starting over. There are two reasons AI will transition from the dedicated solutions we see today to more universal solutions that will dominate the future. The first is the same reason that universal computers won out over dedicated computers. Universal computers are ultimately more cost-effective, and this led to more rapid advances in the technology. As more and more people use the same designs, more effort is applied to enhancing the most popular designs and the ecosystems that support them, leading to rapid improvements in cost and performance. This was the underlying driver of the exponential increase in computing power that shaped industry and society in the latter part of the 20th century. The second reason that AI will transition to universal solutions is that some of the most important future applications of machine intelligence will require the flexibility of universal solutions. These applications will need to handle unanticipated problems and devise novel solutions in a way that today's dedicated deep learning machines cannot. Consider two types of robots. The first robot paints cars in a factory. We want car painting robots to be fast, accurate, and unchanging. We don't want them trying new spraying techniques each day or questioning why they are painting cars. When it comes to painting cars on an assembly line, single-purpose, unintelligent robots are what we need. Now, say we want to send a team of robot construction workers to Mars to build a livable habitat for humans. These robots need to use a variety of tools and assemble buildings in an unstructured environment. They will encounter unforeseen problems and will need to collaboratively improvise fixes and modify designs. Humans can handle these types of issues, but no machine today is close to doing any of this. Mars construction robots will need to possess general-purpose intelligence. You might think that the need for general-purpose intelligent machines will be limited, that most AI applications will be addressed with dedicated single-purpose technologies like we have today. People thought the same thing about general-purpose computers. They argued that the commercial demand for general-purpose computers was limited to a few high-value applications. The opposite turned out to be true. Due to dramatic reductions in cost and size, general-purpose computers became one of the largest and most economically important technologies of the last century. I believe that general-purpose AI will similarly dominate machine intelligence in the latter part of the 21st century. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, when commercial computers first became available, it was impossible to imagine what their applications would be in 1990 or 2000. Today, our imagination is similarly challenged. No one can know how intelligent machines will be used 50 or 60 years from now. When is something intelligent? When should we consider a machine intelligent? Is there a set of criteria we can use? This is analogous to asking, when is a machine a general-purpose computer? To qualify as a general-purpose computer, that is, a universal Turing machine, a machine needs certain components, such as memory, a CPU, and software. You can't detect these ingredients from the outside. For example, I can't tell if my toaster oven has a general-purpose computer inside or a custom chip. The more features my toaster oven has, the more likely it contains a general-purpose computer. But the only sure way to tell is by looking inside and seeing how it works. Similarly, to qualify as intelligent, a machine needs to operate using a set of principles. You can't detect whether a system uses these principles by observing it from the outside. For example, if I see a car driving down the highway, I can't tell if it's being driven by an intelligent human who is learning and adapting as they drive, or by a simple controller that just keeps the car between two lines. The more complex the behavior exhibited by the car, the more likely it is that an intelligent agent is in control. But the only sure way to tell is by looking inside. So, is there a set of criteria that machines must have to be considered intelligent? I think so. My proposal for what qualifies as intelligent is based on the brain. Each of the four attributes in the following list is something we know that the brain does, and that I believe an intelligent machine must do too. I will describe what each attribute is, why it is important, and how the brain implements it. Of course, intelligent machines may implement these attributes differently than a brain. For example, intelligent machines don't have to be made of living cells. Not everyone will agree with my choice of attributes. One can make a good argument that I've left some important things out. That's okay. I view my list as a minimum or baseline for AGI. Few AI systems have any of these attributes today. 1. Learning continuously. What is it? Every waking moment of our entire life, we are learning. How long we remember something varies. Some things are forgotten quickly, such as the arrangement of dishes on a table or what clothes we wore yesterday. Other things will stay with us for our entire lives. Learning is not a separate process from sensing and acting. We learn continuously. Why is it important? The world is constantly changing. Therefore, our model of the world must learn continuously to reflect the changing world. Most AI systems today do not learn continuously. They go through a lengthy training process, and when it is complete, they are deployed. This is one reason they are not flexible. Flexibility requires continuously adjusting to changing conditions and new knowledge. How does the brain do it? The most important component of how brains learn continuously is the neuron. When a neuron learns a new pattern, it forms new synapses on one dendrite branch. The new synapses don't affect previously learned ones on other branches. Thus, learning something new doesn't force the neuron to forget or modify something it learned earlier. The artificial neurons used in today's AI systems don't have this ability. This is one reason they can't learn continuously. 2. Learning via movement. What is it? We learn by moving. As we go about our day, we move our body, our limbs, and our eyes. These movements are integral to how we learn. Why is it important? Intelligence requires learning a model of the world. We cannot sense everything in the world at once. Therefore, movement is required for learning. You cannot learn a model of a house without moving from room to room, and you cannot learn a new app on your smartphone without interacting with it. Movements don't have to be physical. The principle of learning via movement also applies to concepts, such as mathematics, and to virtual spaces, such as the internet. How does the brain do it? The unit of processing in the neocortex is the cortical column. Each column is a complete sensory motor system. That is, it gets inputs and it can generate behaviors. With every movement, a column predicts what its next input will be. Prediction is how a column tests and updates its model. 3. Many models. What is it? The neocortex is composed of tens of thousands of cortical columns, and each column learns models of objects. Knowledge about any particular thing, such as a coffee cup, is distributed among many complementary models. Why is it important? The many models design of the neocortex provides flexibility. By adopting this architecture, AI designers can easily create machines that integrate multiple types of sensors, such as vision and touch, or even novel sensors, such as radar. And they can create machines that have varied embodiments. Like the neocortex, the brain of an intelligent machine will consist of many nearly identical elements that can then be connected to a variety of movable sensors. How does the brain do it? The key to making the many models' design work is voting. Each column operates somewhat independently, but long-range connections in the neocortex allow columns to vote on what object they are sensing. 4. Using reference frames to store knowledge. What is it? In the brain, knowledge is stored in reference frames. Reference frames are also used to make predictions, create plans, and perform movements. Thinking occurs as the brain activates one location at a time in a reference frame, and the associated piece of knowledge is retrieved. Why is it important? To be intelligent, a machine needs to learn a model of the world. That model must include the shape of objects, how they change as we interact with them, and where they are relative to each other. Reference frames are needed to represent this kind of information. They are the backbone of knowledge. How does the brain do it? Each cortical column establishes its own set of reference frames. We have proposed that cortical columns create reference frames using cells that are equivalent to grid cells and place cells. Examples of reference frames. Most artificial neural networks have nothing equivalent to reference frames. For example, a typical neural network that recognizes images just assigns a label to each image. Without reference frames, the network has no way of learning the 3D structure of objects or how they move and change. One of the problems with a system like this is that we can't ask why it labeled something a cat. The AI system doesn't know what a cat is. There is no further information to be had beyond that this image is similar to other images that were labeled cat. Some forms of AI do have reference frames, although the way they are implemented is limiting. For example, a computer that plays chess has a reference frame, the chessboard. Locations on a chessboard are noted in chess-specific nomenclature, such as King's Rook 4 or Queen 7. The chess-playing computer uses this reference frame to represent the location of each piece, to represent legal chess moves, and to plan movements. A chessboard reference frame is inherently two-dimensional and has only 64 locations. This is fine for chess, but it is useless for learning the structure of staplers or the behaviors of cats. Self-driving cars typically have multiple reference frames. One is GPS, the satellite-based system that can locate the car anywhere on Earth. Using a GPS reference frame, a car can learn where roads, intersections, and buildings are. GPS is a more general-purpose reference frame than a chessboard, but it is anchored to Earth, and therefore can't represent the structure or shape of things that move relative to Earth, such as a kite or a bicycle. Robot designers are accustomed to using reference frames. They use them to keep track of where a robot is in the world and to plan how it should move from one location to another. Most roboticists are not concerned about AGI, whereas most AI researchers are unaware of the importance of reference frames. Today, AI and robotics are largely separate fields of research, although the line is starting to blur. Once AI researchers understand the essential role of movement and reference frames for creating AGI, the separation between artificial intelligence and robotics will disappear completely. One AI scientist who understands the importance of reference frames is Jeffrey Hinton. Today's neural networks rely on ideas that Hinton developed in the 1980s. Recently, he has become critical of the field because deep learning networks lack any sense of location and, therefore, he argues, they can't learn the structure of the world. In essence, this is the same criticism I am making, that AI needs reference frames. Hinton has proposed a solution to this problem that he calls capsules. Capsules promise dramatic improvements in neural networks, but so far they have not caught on in mainstream applications of AI. Whether capsules succeed or whether future AI relies on grid cell-like mechanisms as I have proposed remains to be seen. Either way, intelligence requires reference frames. Finally, let's consider animals. All mammals have a neocortex and therefore are all, by my definition, intelligent, general-purpose learners. Every neocortex, big or small, has general-purpose reference frames defined by cortical grid cells. A mouse has a small neocortex. Therefore, the capacity of what it can learn is limited compared to an animal with a larger neocortex. But I would say a mouse is intelligent in the same way that the computer in my toaster is a universal Turing machine. The toaster's computer is a small yet complete implementation of Turing's idea. Similarly, a mouse brain is a small yet complete implementation of the learning attributes described in this chapter. Intelligence in the animal world is not limited to mammals. For example, birds and octopuses learn and exhibit complex behaviors. It is almost certain that these animals also have reference frames in their brains, although it remains to be discovered whether they have something like grid cells and place cells or a different mechanism. These examples show that almost every system that exhibits planning and complex goal-oriented behavior, whether it be a chess-playing computer, a self-driving car, or a human, has reference frames. The type of reference frame dictates what the system can learn. A reference frame designed for a specific task, such as playing chess, will not be useful in other domains. General-purpose intelligence requires general-purpose reference frames that can be applied to many types of problems. It is worth emphasizing again that intelligence cannot be measured by how well a machine performs a single task, or even several tasks. Instead, intelligence is determined by how a machine learns and stores knowledge about the world. We are intelligent, not because we can do one thing particularly well, but because we can learn to do practically anything. The extreme flexibility of human intelligence requires the attributes I described in this chapter. Continuous learning, learning through movement, learning many models, and using general-purpose reference frames for storing knowledge and generating goal-oriented behaviors. In the future, I believe almost all forms of machine intelligence will have these attributes, although we are a long way from that today. There is a group of people who will argue that I have ignored the most important topic related to intelligence, consciousness. I will address this in the next chapter. Chapter 9. When Machines Are Conscious. I recently attended a panel discussion titled Being Human in the Age of Intelligent Machines. At one point during the evening, a philosophy professor from Yale said that if a machine ever became conscious, then we would probably be morally obligated not to turn it off. The implication was that if something is conscious, even a machine, then it has moral rights, so turning it off is equivalent to murder. Wow. Imagine being sent to prison for unplugging a computer. Should we be concerned about this? Most neuroscientists don't talk much about consciousness. They assume that the brain can be understood like every other physical system, and consciousness, whatever it is, will be explained in the same way. Since there isn't even an agreement on what the word consciousness means, it is best not to worry about it. Philosophers, on the other hand, love to talk and write books about consciousness. Some believe that consciousness is beyond physical description. That is, even if you had a full understanding of how the brain works, it would not explain consciousness. Philosopher David Chalmers famously claimed that consciousness is the hard problem, whereas understanding how the brain works is the easy problem. This phrase caught on, and now many people just assume that consciousness is an inherently unsolvable problem. Personally, I see no reason to believe that consciousness is beyond explanation. I don't want to get into debates with philosophers, nor do I want to try to define consciousness. However, the Thousand Brains theory suggests physical explanations for several aspects of consciousness. For example, the way the brain learns models of the world is intimately tied to our sense of self and how we form beliefs. What I want to do in this chapter is describe what brain theory says about a few aspects of consciousness. I will stick to what we know about the brain and let you decide what, if anything, remains to be explained. Awareness. Imagine if I could reset your brain to the exact state it was in when you woke up this morning. Before I reset you, you would get up and go about your day, doing the things you normally do. Perhaps on this day you washed your car. At dinner time, I would reset your brain to the time you got up, undoing any changes, including any changes to the synapses that occurred during the day. Therefore, all memories of what you did would be erased. After I reset your brain, you would believe that you just woke up. If I then told you that you had washed your car today, you would at first protest, claiming it wasn't true. Upon showing you a video of you washing your car, you might admit that it indeed looks like you had, but you could not have been conscious at the time. You might also claim that you shouldn't be held responsible for anything you did during the day because you were not conscious when you did it. Of course, you were conscious when you washed your car. It is only after deleting your memories of the day that you would believe and claim you were not. This thought experiment shows that our sense of awareness, what many people would call being conscious, requires that we form moment-to-moment memories of our actions. Consciousness also requires that we form moment-to-moment memories of our thoughts. Recall that thinking is just a sequential activation of neurons in the brain. We can remember a sequence of thoughts just as we can remember the sequence of notes in a melody. If we didn't remember our thoughts, we would be unaware of why we were doing anything. For example, we have all experienced going to a room in our house to do something, but upon entering the room, forgetting what we went there for. When this happens, we often ask ourselves, "Where was I just before I got here? And what was I thinking?" We try to recall the memory of our recent thoughts, so we know why we are now standing in the kitchen. When our brains are working properly, The neurons form a continuous memory of both our thoughts and actions. Therefore, when we get to the kitchen, we can recall the thoughts we had earlier. We retrieve the recently stored memory of thinking about eating the last piece of cake in the refrigerator, and we know why we went to the kitchen. The active neurons in the brain at some moments represent our present experience, and at other moments represent a previous experience or a previous thought. It is this accessibility of the past, the ability to jump back in time and slide forward again to the present, that gives us our sense of presence and awareness. If we couldn't replay our recent thoughts and experiences, then we would be unaware that we are alive. Our moment-to-moment memories are not permanent. We typically forget them within hours or days. I remember what I had for breakfast today, but I will lose this memory in a day or two. It is common that our ability to form short-term memories declines with age. That is why we have more and more of the "why did I come here" experiences as we get older. These thought experiments prove that our awareness, our sense of presence, which is the central part of consciousness, is dependent on continuously forming memories of our recent thoughts and experiences, and playing them back as we go about our day. Now, let's say we create an intelligent machine. The machine learns a model of the world using the same principles as a brain. The internal states of the machine's model of the world are equivalent to the states of neurons in the brain. If our machine remembers these states as they occur and can replay these memories, then would it be aware and conscious of its existence in the same way that you and I are? I believe so. If you believe that consciousness cannot be explained by scientific investigation and the known laws of physics, then you might argue that I have shown that storing and recalling the states of a brain is necessary, but I have not proven that is sufficient. If you take this view, then the burden is on you to show why it is not sufficient. For me, the sense of awareness, the sense of presence, the feeling that I am an acting agent in the world, is the core of what it means to be conscious. It is easily explained by the activity of neurons, and I see no mystery in it. Qualia. The nerve fibers that enter the brain from the eyes, ears, and skin look the same. Not only do they look identical, they transmit information using identical-looking spikes. If you look at the inputs to the brain, you can't discern what they represent. Yet vision feels like one thing and hearing feels like something different, and neither feels like spikes. When you look at a pastoral scene, you don't sense the tut-tut-tut of electrical spikes entering your brain. You see hills and color and shadows. Qualia is the name for how sensory inputs are perceived, how they feel. Qualia are puzzling. Given that all sensations are created by identical spikes, why does sensing feel different than touching? And why do some input spikes result in the sensation of pain, and others don't? These may seem like silly questions, but if you imagine that the brain is sitting in the skull and its inputs are just spikes, then you can get a sense of the mystery. Where do our perceived sensations come from? The origin of qualia is considered one of the mysteries of consciousness. Qualia are part of the brain's model of the world. Qualia are subjective, which means they are internal experiences. For example, I know what a pickle tastes like to me, but I can't know if a pickle tastes the same to you. Even if we use the same words to describe the taste of a pickle, it is still possible that you and I perceive pickles differently. Sometimes we actually know that the same input is perceived differently by different people. A recent famous example of this is a photograph of a dress that some people see as white and gold, and other people see as black and blue. The exact same picture can result in different perceptions of color. This tells us that the qualia of color is not purely a property of the physical world. If it were, we would all say the dress has the same color. The color of the dress is a property of our brain's model of the world. If two people perceive the same input differently, that tells us their model is different. There is a fire station near my home that has a red fire truck outside in the driveway. The surface of the truck always appears red, even though the frequency and intensity of the light reflected off it varies. The light changes with the angle of the sun, the weather, and the orientation of the truck in the driveway. Yet, I don't perceive the color of the truck changing. This tells us that there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between what we perceive as red and a particular frequency of light. Red is related to particular frequencies of light, but what we perceive as red is not always the same frequency. The redness of the fire truck is a fabrication of the brain. It is a property of the brain's model of surfaces, not a property of light per se. Some qualia are learned via movements, similar to how we learn objects. If qualia are a property of the brain's model of the world, then how does the brain create them? Recall that the brain learns models of the world by movement. To learn what a coffee cup feels like, you must move your fingers over the coffee cup, touching it at different locations. Some qualia are learned in a similar way, via movement. Imagine you are holding a green piece of paper in your hand. As you look at it, you move it. First, you look at the paper straight on, then you angle it to the left, then right, then up, then down. As you change the angle of the paper, the frequency and intensity of light entering your eyes changes, and thus the pattern of spikes entering your brain also changes. As you move an object, such as the piece of green paper, your brain predicts how the light will change. We can be certain this prediction is occurring, because if the light didn't change, or it changed differently than normal as you moved the paper, you would notice that something was wrong. This is because the brain has models for how surfaces reflect light at different angles. There are different models for different types of surfaces. We might call the model of one surface green and another red. How would a model of a surface's color be learned? Imagine we have a reference frame for surfaces we call green. The reference frame for green is different than the reference frame for an object, such as a coffee cup, in one important way. A reference frame for the cup represents sensed inputs at different locations on the cup. A reference frame for a green surface represents sensed inputs at different orientations of the surface. You might find it difficult to imagine a reference frame that represents orientations, but from a theory point of view, the two types of reference frames are similar. The same basic mechanism that the brain uses to learn models of coffee cups could also learn models of colors. Without further evidence, I don't know if the qualia of color are actually modeled this way. I mention this example because it shows that it is possible to construct testable theories and neural explanations for how we learn and experience qualia. It shows that qualia may not lie outside of the realm of normal scientific explanation, as some people believe. Not all qualia are learned. For example, the feeling of pain is almost certainly innate, mediated by special pain receptors and old brain structures, not the neocortex. If you touch a hot stove, your arm will retract in pain before your neocortex knows what is happening. Therefore, pain can't be understood in the same way as the color green, which I am proposing is learned in the neocortex. When we feel pain, it is out there, at some location on our body. Location is part of the qualia of pain, and we have a solid explanation for why it is perceived at different locations. But I don't have an explanation for why pain hurts, or why it feels the way it does and not like something else. This doesn't bother me in any deep way. There are many things we don't yet understand about the brain, but the steady progress we have made gives me confidence that these and other issues related to qualia can be understood in the normal course of neuroscience research and discovery. The neuroscience of consciousness. There are neuroscientists who study consciousness. On one end of a spectrum are neuroscientists who believe that consciousness is likely to be beyond normal scientific explanation. They study the brain to look for neural activity that correlates with consciousness, but they do not believe neural activity can explain it. They suggest that perhaps consciousness can never be understood, or maybe it is created by quantum effects or undiscovered laws of physics. Personally, I can't understand this point of view. Why would we ever assume something can't be understood? The long history of human discovery has shown again and again that things that at first appear to be beyond comprehension ultimately have logical explanations. If a scientist makes the extraordinary claim that consciousness cannot be explained by neural activity, we should be skeptical, and the burden should be on them to show why. There are other neuroscientists who study consciousness who believe that it can be understood like any other physical phenomenon. If consciousness seems mysterious, they argue, it is only because we don't yet understand the mechanisms, and perhaps we are not thinking about the problem correctly. My colleagues and I are squarely in this camp. So is Princeton neuroscientist Michael Graziano. He has proposed that a particular region of the neocortex models attention, similar to how somatic regions of the neocortex model the body. He proposes that the brain's model of attention leads us to believe we are conscious, in the same way that the brain's model of the body leads us to believe we have an arm or a leg. I don't know if Graziano's theory is correct, but to me, it represents the right approach. Notice that his theory is based on the neocortex learning a model of attention. If he is right, I would wager that the model is built using grid cell-like reference frames. Machine consciousness. If it is true that consciousness is just a physical phenomenon, then what should we expect about intelligent machines and consciousness? I have no doubts that machines that work on the same principles as the brain will be conscious. AI systems don't work this way today, but in the future they will, and they will be conscious. I also have no doubts that many animals, especially other mammals, are also conscious. They don't have to tell us for us to know. We can tell they are conscious by seeing that their brains work similarly to ours. Do we have a moral obligation to not turn off a conscious machine? Would that be equivalent to murder? No. I would have no concerns about unplugging a conscious machine. First, consider that we humans turn off every night when we go to sleep. We turn on again when we wake. That, in my mind, is no different than unplugging a conscious machine and plugging it in again later. What about destroying an intelligent machine when it is unplugged or just never plugging it in again? Wouldn't that be akin to murdering a person while they are asleep? Not really. Our fear of death is created by the older parts of our brain. If we detect a life-threatening situation, then the old brain creates the sensation of fear, and we start acting in more reflexive ways. When we lose someone close to us, we mourn and feel sad. Fears and emotions are created by neurons in the old brain when they release hormones and other chemicals into the body. The neocortex may help the old brain decide when to release these chemicals, but without the old brain, we would not sense fear or sadness. Fear of death and sorrow for loss are not required ingredients for a machine to be conscious or intelligent. Unless we go out of our way to give machines equivalent fears and emotions, they will not care at all if they are shut down, disassembled, or scrapped. It is possible that a human could become attached to an intelligent machine. Perhaps they shared many experiences, and the human feels a personal connection with it. In that case, we would have to consider the harm caused to the human if we turned off the machine. But there wouldn't be a moral obligation to the intelligent machine itself. If we went out of our way to give intelligent machines fears and emotions, then I would take a different position. But intelligence and consciousness on their own do not create this kind of moral dilemma. The mystery of life and the mystery of consciousness. Not that long ago, the question, what is life, was as mysterious as what is consciousness. It seemed impossible to explain why some pieces of matter were alive and others were not. To many people, this mystery seemed beyond scientific explanation. In 1907, philosopher Henri Bergson introduced a mysterious thing he called élan vital to explain the difference between living and non-living things. According to Bergson, inanimate matter became living matter with the addition of élan vital. Importantly, élan vital was not physical and could not be understood by normal scientific study. With the discovery of genes, DNA, and the entire field of biochemistry, we no longer view living matter as unexplainable. There are still many unanswered questions about life, such as, how did it begin? Is it common in the universe? Is a virus a living thing? And can life exist using different molecules and chemistry? But these questions, and the debates they create, are on the edge. Scientists no longer debate whether life is explainable. At some point, it became clear that life can be understood as biology and chemistry. Concepts like élan vital became a part of history. I expect that a similar change of attitude will occur with consciousness. At some point in the future, we will accept that any system that learns a model of the world continuously remembers the states of that model and recalls the remembered states will be conscious. There will be remaining unanswered questions, but consciousness will no longer be talked about as the hard problem. It won't even be considered a problem.